Got a real pleasure now to welcome to the program the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs and Staff of the United States, General Richard Myers. General, welcome to the program. It's great to have you.
Hugh, it's good to be on with you.
General, after 3 years of war and the deployments in Afghanistan and Iraq and the long occupation, what's the readiness of the U.S. military today?
We are very ready, thanks to some good budgets the last several years, good support from Congress, good bipartisan support from Congress. Our readiness funding has been very, very good, and so we are a very ready force, despite the fact that we've been very busy and that we're using equipment up at a great rate. It means in the future, though, that we've got to pay attention to refurbishing some of the equipment and replacing some of the equipment that we're using up, as I said before, at a rate that is much higher than the peacetime rate.
Any concern that some of these divisions that have come back from Iraq are now graded at below readiness level, or is that just routine?
That's routine, and they come back. If you think about it, when they come off the battlefield, they've been working over there as a team in very tough conditions for a year or so, and they trained up before that, so they probably are as ready as they'll ever be when they come back to the United States of America. But then our contract to them is to give them time to rest, refit, and get ready for their next mission. And so it's all expected. It's all programmed. That's how we try to manage the force.
General Myers, yesterday, former Air Force Chief of Staff Tony McPeak said in a press release, he's working with John Kerry, that, quote, "The troops are paying for the price of arrogant mismanagement and poor planning at the civilian policy level. The force we have in Iraq today is part of what I call an in-between force, too small to solve the problem, too big to be supported by our force structure." He was particularly critical of the call-up of 5,600 soldiers from the individual ready reserve. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, I don't want to respond directly. I have, a lot of respect for General McPeak. He was Chief of Staff of the Air Force, and I worked for him at one point in my career, and clearly now being associated with a political campaign, I don't want to directly comment. But let me talk about the individual ready reserve, which you mentioned.
Right.
You know, it's the thing that I think people miss. It's in the contract. When people sign up, being part of the individual ready reserve is part of the contract they make with the U.S. government. And this is a management tool that we're using to bring people back to active duty that have an obligation to come back to active duty if asked, and fulfill certain tasks. And I would tell you, I think it's 55 or 5,600 that the Army is calling up. The Marines have been doing this for some time now, and the Army is needing to do it because there's certain critical specialties where we need their expertise. There are 1,000 volunteers in that number, by the way, 1,000 people who volunteer. So I think people, especially people in the armed forces, understand the stakes here and want to serve. And clearly, you know, we ask them to sacrifice a lot. Folks that have gotten out or in the individual ready reserve have other lives, and now we're going to pull them back to active duty. That's a big sacrifice for them, their families, their employers, no doubt, and we appreciate it. On the other hand, I think if you ask them, probably most of them want the opportunity to serve.
General Myers, yesterday Secretary Rumsfeld said, and Vice President Cheney said it the week before, that more warheads containing sarin or mustard gas have been discovered in Iraq. Have you seen those reports?
Right. I think there were 16 or 17 warheads that were discovered, and it's been confirmed that they contained both sarin, the nerve agent sarin, and mustard gas. And now they're looking at the shells to try to determine, you know, their age and perhaps where they originated. So that work is ongoing. I expect there to be further reporting on that.
Are the troops currently deployed in Iraq still on guard against the use of WMD against them?
Well, we're always on guard against for that, and occasionally you'll see a report. You've got to remember that this fellow Zarqawi, who is one of the leaders of the foreign terrorist element inside Iraq, that he has dabbled in poisons mainly, but those sorts of things. So we have to be on guard regarding our food and perhaps other types of attacks where people could use chemical or biological weapons against us. And so that's something we're always on guard against. We're not at the same level of alert that we were when we came into Iraq from Kuwait when this began, where people were actually wearing their protective gear. We're not in that status today.
General, going back to the jump off of Operation Iraqi Freedom last March, did you personally expect weapons of mass destruction to be used against the troops?
I did, in fact, because As you know, as we marched from Kuwait to Baghdad, we found, I forget the exact number, I think it's something like 3,000 protective suits that the Iraqis had pre-positioned in southern Iraq. We picked up other intelligence that said they were in terms of their command and control. So that's why the troops were dressed the way they were in their protective gear all the way from Kuwait to Baghdad, because we expected that. That is not something you don't make those decisions to wear that kind of gear lightly, because it is very hot and it degrades performance. So it's not something you do lightly. And those troops that did that all the way to Baghdad in the kind of conditions that we saw on the television are to be commended for that.
When you hear commentators outside of the military talking about Bush lied, the administration deceived us about WMD, what do you think about that analysis?
Well, my job is to focus on the military aspect of our business, and I try to represent our armed forces that are both there in Afghanistan, Djibouti, the Philippines, around the world, on the front line, I think, of defense of this country and our friends of allies against this extremist threat. This is, you know, we're in a political season. People will say lots of things. I try to keep my eye on the security ball. As you know, the military is not political in this country, and I think that's you know that better than anybody, because
sure,
you're the constitutional lawyer. But it's the way it ought to be, and we try to live up to that.
Let's go back to readiness, General. Does the Army have enough divisions and the Navy sailors and ships and the Air Force pilots and planes? Is it? I know you got the readiness funding, but is there physically a big enough force for the number of challenges? You just detailed a few in the Philippines and Southeast Asia that are there.
Hugh, a very good question, and it gets a lot of debate today. Here's how the Joint Chiefs of Staff look at that. The Navy actually wants to reduce strength. Admiral Vern Clark, the Chief of Naval Operations, thinks he has savings there, and he wants to save the tremendous dollars you put into personnel by actually reducing strength and becoming more efficient on the way they deploy and on some of the newer ships that require less manpower. The Marine Corps and the Air Force are about set. Actually, the Air Force wants to go up a couple of thousand security forces, mainly for some of the new security tasks. The Army is the one that is really stretched right now, and what the Chief of Staff of the Army wants to do is make more of the Army usable for deployments. And he says, if you can give me an extra 30,000 people in my allocation, we call it end strength, but 30,000 people above what I'm authorized, I can use that as shock absorber while I essentially create more usable forces, 25% more usable forces, and that'll take me a couple of years. And then we need to look at, if I get more usability out of the United States Army, then it's time to look at, given the security environment we see coming our way, should we continue to increase the size of the Army? But before we do that, we've got to make most effective and efficient use out of those forces that are already assigned. So that's the Chief of Staff of the Army's view, the Acting Secretary of the Army's view. That's the Joint Chiefs of Staff view. So right now, other than the things I said about the other services, we don't think we need a strength increase. We have to wait and try to get more usable forces out of the forces that the taxpayers have given us.
General Myers, I've got a very narrow question, but a lot of us who use the Internet for a living and blog for a living are interested in this. There are a lot of military bloggers out there, individual active duty servicemen and women who put their thoughts, their impressions of their duty stations and the world around them onto the Internet in mil blogs. What's your opinion of that? I love them. I hope you keep them. But what's the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff think about those?
I don't see that many of them, but based on this conversation, Hugh, I will see more of them. But I think, when you get to the four-star level, you fight to get information from the troops, and you don't want to be victim of just getting fed what the staff brings you every day. So ways you work that is through the Internet, as you just mentioned, or you visit places. You go to Iraq, you go to Afghanistan, and you try to get down to the individual soldier, Airman, Sailor, Marine level, Coast Guardsman, DOD civilian, and yet, look them in the eye and say, how's it going? And try to establish enough rapport where they'll tell you. And it's at my level, it's a constant fight to make sure you're getting the straight skinny. And so I think it's a good idea that I plug into some of those too in my spare time.
Now, they're great things. And, General, I want to thank you for your time. We always make a habit here of whenever an active duty calls up, thanking them for their service, and that extends all the way to the top. Thank you for your service, General, and for spending time with us on The Hugh Hewitt Show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.